This hearing in the Senate Health and Social Services Committee will now come to order. Today is Thursday, March 19th, and the time is 3:31. We are in Butrovich, room 205. Members present are Senator Tobin, Vice Chair Giesel, myself, Chair Dunbar, and online, we have, we have Senator Myers. Senator Klayman is at a bill presentation. We expect him along shortly. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Before we begin, I'd like to thank Mary Gwen Kawakami, the Senate and Social Services Recording Secretary, and Kyla Tupo from Juno LIO for staffing the committee today. So I see Senator Myers has sent me a message, so he can text me if he wants to ask a question. We have two items on our agenda today. First, a presentation on the rising costs of health care and health insurance in Alaska. After that, we will have an initial hearing for SB 276 contraceptives insurance coverage. So to start our presentation today, we have three folks. We have Jared Kosin, CEO of the Alaska Hospital and Healthcare Association, Heather Carpenter, Director of Division of Insurance, Shayla Teague, Area Director for ARC Insurance Solutions. She's on Teams. So we'll start with you, Mr. Kosin. If you please come forward, put yourself on the record and begin your presentation.
For the record, my name is Jared Kosin, and I am the President and CEO of the Alaska Hospital and Healthcare Association. I want to thank the committee for having me here today, and today I will talk about the rising costs of healthcare, and I'm going to do so, it'll be brief, but I'm going to do so by covering three areas. I'm going to start by talking about the expiration of the enhanced premium tax credits. Then I'm going to talk about other coverage loss events that will be coming in 2027, and then kind of conclude with the pressure all of this puts on the care delivery system and, of course, healthcare costs. So jumping right into the advanced premium tax credits, and please, obviously, I defer to the chair, but ask questions anytime you want. You don't need to wait to the end or anything like that. But the advanced premium tax credits, just by way of context, are subsidies that individuals and families in poverty use to purchase insurance on the Affordable Care Act exchange. In 2021 and 2022, they were enhanced or increased. And then in December 31st, just a couple months ago, those enhancements expired. Congress failed to extend them, and now they're gone. When we look at these enhancements, we know from the Division of Insurance, between, depending on what year you look at, 26,000 to 28,000 Alaskans rely on a subsidy to purchase insurance. And when you look at the difference between the enhancements falling off, we're talking about $43 million in lost subsidy support. So we lost $43 million that were going towards these subsidies on December 31st. When we lost that, we essentially saw a doubling and tripling of insurance premiums for the individuals on the ACA. And as you can imagine, with our cost of insurance, when you have a doubling and a tripling of premiums, people are put in a situation where they just cannot afford that. And so we know, certainly based on past committee hearings and testimony and such, but we know people are put in the position of having to forego coverage. And that takes us to the topic of uncompensated care. When someone does not have coverage anymore, and that's any kind of insurance, and they, you know, need healthcare services and they go get it, if those services are provided to a person without coverage, the services are essentially unpaid for. And so we call that uncompensated or uncompensated care. When there is a loss of healthcare coverage, inevitably there's an increase to uncompensated care. That's just how it works. And as uncompensated care rises, one of two things happens, or frankly, both. Providers who are providing services, they're going to have all these costs that are unpaid for, uncompensated, and they're put in a position where they either have to shift those costs to someone who can pay for them, and that does happen, and that is shifted to essentially private insurance, and that's part of the reason you see premiums rise for everybody. And or they will reduce services. they'll either outright cut the services they're providing, or they'll cap the number of individuals who don't have insurance that they can see. And most providers do that. They have to limit how many people they can see just to be able to stay in service. That does not apply to hospitals. Hospitals, by law, have to see anyone regardless of their ability to pay. So with that, so we know, just kind of taking a quick sum up where we've gone so far, 26 to 28,000 Alaskans rely on subsidy. We know the subsidy had been enhanced for a number of years. That enhancement has expired. It cost us $43 million in Alaska. Lots of premiums doubled and tripled. We know people are losing care. We've gone into higher uncompensated care. So if you take that on its own, and now you fast forward to a year, we expect more coverage loss to happen in 2027. And what I mean by that is, if you follow what happened with HR1, which is the federal bill that passed this summer, the Department of Health just put out a report on one of the requirements, just one of the requirements from HR1 around work requirements in Medicaid. And that report finds that once these work requirements are put into place, they expect on the high end that 13,611 Alaskans will lose Medicaid coverage. And I want to talk about that number for a minute, because it is qualified as the higher end. When you look at the work requirements and who they're going to apply to, they'd apply to the Medicaid expansion population. We have approximately 61,000 Alaskans in expansion. For that number, that high-end number, for to happen, the report assumes the state will be able to automatically clear 42,000 of the 61,000 without contacting them, just using current data systems in place. They'll be able to automatically exempt them. And on top of that, it assumes another 5,000 individuals are going to successfully demonstrate compliance with the work requirements on their own manually. And so what I'm trying to tell you is, essentially, for 13,000 people to lose coverage, it assumes the state has to be flawless, perfect, on exempting a lot of people, 42,000 plus. It also assumes 5,000 people have to be perfect in the way in which they comply. So I'd say that because if I had to bet, and not that my opinion necessarily matters, but 13,000, maybe it'll be lower. I think there's a chance it's higher, that we'll see more people than that lose coverage. On top of that event, we also know from HR1 that Medicaid redeterminations are going to happen more frequently for people on expansion. Instead of being your Medicaid eligibility happening annually, it's going to move to 6 months for certain people in the population, in the expansion population. We know, just like any private insurance event, when you go through a new insurance year or a new qualifying event, someone inevitably always falls off because they don't file the right paperwork. And so we can guarantee more people will fall off from that. How many, we don't know. But the point is, more loss of coverage. And so if you look at this from an impact standpoint, you know, at a minimum, we talked about the enhanced premium tax credits. You know, pretty high numbers from that. We talked about the work requirements, certainly a high number from that. The redeterminations could be coming. We have a lot of people who are losing coverage. And my concern is, from a consumer standpoint, when you're trying to evaluate the rising cost of healthcare, I think we all agree there's a really appropriate or recommended way to get healthcare. And one such way is not just going straight to the emergency department. And one such way is not foregoing care because no one will see you. And as a consumer, that's exactly what happens in this situation. If you don't have care, you might not be able to get in with a primary care physician, nurse practitioner, or anyone just because of the limits on people's panels. They might not be able to fit you. And on top of that, you might wait, and at some point you're going to get sick enough where you can't wait, and then you're going to be really hard to care for, and you're going to be, frankly, more expensive to care for in a hospital setting. And the other alternative is you go straight to the ER for every need. And people do that. And that's an extremely expensive way to get healthcare. So the idea that we're going to be essentially compelling or compounding that habit, that idea of we're funneling people to the emergency department, is because of the rising uncompensated care, will inevitably drive up healthcare costs even more than they are today. And so what I'm trying to say as I kind of wrap up here is the cost of healthcare is too expensive. I could sit here and talk to you quite a bit about other drivers around chronic conditions. There's really interesting statistics on how much individuals cost and how much of their share of our expenses they hold and strategies for addressing that. But if you just look at uncompensated care alone, which is pretty overwhelming and it's a pretty fraught system, the last thing we want to see when you're trying to address healthcare costs are people losing coverage. You actually want people to have more coverage, because if people have more coverage, then they can more efficiently access healthcare services, i.e. at a primary care doctor's office, at a community-based services, all those lower level services. And so what we're seeing with some of the policies that are coming down the pike, we're setting ourselves up for kind of the opposite of that trend. And I fear that as we all talk about this cost argument, well, I just talked about one segment of it today. Unfortunately, we expect it to get quite a bit worse. And so I'm going to conclude there. And I appreciate the opportunity to be here, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Cosin. I should note for the record that we have the Division of Insurance's presentation up on our screens, but Mr. Cosin does not represent the Division of Insurance. He's from the Hospital and Healthcare Association. That's the next presentation will come from the Division of Insurance. Are there any questions for Mr. Cosin? Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Cosin, I'm going to ask a question that I've heard a few folks say, which is why not just let people die? What happens if we don't provide care? What happens to our communities, to our society, if we say, all right, you shouldn't have healthcare access?
Through the chair, Senator, that's a good question. Of all the questions I anticipated, that is not one I anticipated. I would respond that that's just not what we are or who we are as human beings and the society I think we've set up. I think we have safety net programs in place, and the idea that even if you want to look at it from an economic standpoint, you know, we can't be a productive people and have a productive state if we simply let people languish without getting healthcare. So, I mean, I think it's a priority in any way, whether you want to look at it from a human element or an economic element. I think our state would be far worse. I think economically, we wouldn't be very attractive for people to come here if we set up that scenario. Now, certainly there's choices where people no longer want healthcare, you know, if they're in a decision where they want to decide their own fate. But by and large, if we give people access to some of the most basic things, we can address things like chronic disease and some of those longer term, more expensive conditions that will allow people to have better lives and, frankly, lower healthcare.
Brief follow-up?
Yes, Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And if someone comes to your facilities, if someone comes in the hospital situation, can you just let them languish?
Well, are they coming to our facility with the intent to languish, or are they coming to get care?
If they're coming into your facility and they are in need, can you deny them that care?
No. Through the chair, no. You'd come through the emergency department immediately, MTALA, which is a federal law. We have a duty to treat anyone regardless to pay, and we would not do that. Yes, we will provide health care no matter what.
Even uncompensated.
Correct. Even uncompensated.
Very good. Thank you, Senator Tobin. Senator Myers has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Cosin, I was really hoping that either you or Ms. Carpenter would go a little bit, you know, more into the drivers of healthcare costs, because, you know, the presentation was listed under the rising cost of healthcare, and so I understand your point about how uncompensated care and loss of coverage can drive higher expenses later on. But it feels like if we're just talking about who is going to subsidize care, whether it's us at the state level or at the federal level, it feels like in the end what we're doing is we're just pushing off the inevitable because healthcare costs are rising at an unsustainable rate. So I really appreciate some more comments on what we can do in terms of policy at the state level or just kind of what needs to happen in society in general for us to finally get a handle on healthcare costs and push them down without going the direction of eventually just telling, eventually just rationing care. That feels like the direction that we're going ever since the ACA was passed. Could you comment on that a little, please?
Yes, through the chair. Thank you for the question. I would actually have the opposite conclusion. I don't think we've been rationing care since the ACA passed. I think it's the opposite. But for the record, what I would say is this. Uncompensated care and lack of coverage to access care is a driver of rising healthcare costs. It's a core driver. If people don't have coverage or insurance or whatever form it comes in, it drives behavior in our healthcare system, and it's driving people to become sicker, which is increasing the cost for everybody. So unfortunately, and I understand people have different philosophical views on this, but I would argue today or for the record state that if you want to address the cost of healthcare, you have to address coverage. You have to. But I would also agree with your question about there are other drivers, lots of other drivers. One driver that I'm particularly interested in is socioeconomic drivers of health. I mean, you can go down all the way to the basic stuff to childhood education, trauma. I mean, all this stuff is so far upstream and downstream that really by the time you're getting to the healthcare system, we're a symptom of a much broader issue. But I would point this out, just a couple of statistics. If you want to know one of the big cost drivers, if you take Medicaid, and this same statistic would likely apply to private insurance, but the top 20% of Medicaid recipients in Alaska by cost account for 81% of total Medicaid spending in the entire program. And so we know, a small number of people are driving all the costs. And if you go another layer deeper, the average Medicaid spending per person with a diagnosis, without a diagnosis of a chronic condition in 2024 was $4,581. So keep that number with you for a minute. The average spending per person who is diagnosed with one or more chronic conditions was $26,499. That's six times higher. So that tells me, another driver that I would go deeper on policy is how do you address people with chronic conditions and how do you get to the root of that to prevent it from being so expensive? There's a preventative element on the socioeconomic pieces I talked about. There's also a screening and maintenance element, which directly ties to coverage. If you are uncovered, you're more likely than not going to be able to access some of the basic, simple things that are cheap that could really help you manage your condition through a practitioner.
Thank you, Mr. Cosin. Thank you, Senator Myers. I'll just remind the folks that this is part one of a three-part. We have two other presenters today on this topic, and hopefully we'll get to them soon. We have one more question from Senator Klayman.
A follow-up in some of the questions from Senator Myers. Specifically in Alaska, what about more training and more people qualified as medical providers, nurses, nurse practitioners, physicians, assistants, physicians? Is that part of what we need to do in Alaska to improve access to healthcare and make it more affordable?
Through the chair, Senator Klayman, yes. There are multiple drivers to the cost problem. And I think you guys are echoing that in your questions very well. But yeah, we have a worker shortage across virtually all provider types. in all clinical and non-clinical positions. I mean, we've documented it through a study we do every year from Department of Labor Statistics. But that's another choke point in access. If you don't have people to provide care, then you can't go get care. And so with worker shortages, it becomes even more challenging. So these are all elements that fit in to the broader problem. The other piece to it, too, is, you know, labor is more expensive in Alaska. That's just a fact. And labor is the number one expense in providing health care, generally speaking. I mean, of course, supplies, prescription drugs, things like that also come into play. But yeah, I mean, when you have a worker shortage and you don't have the type of specialties you need up here, you can't provide care efficiently. I'm going to give you one example. I know my time's probably pretty limited, but if you go into a hospital right now in our state, on average, we are boarding, and I use the word boarding very deliberately, 200 people at any given time who are inside a hospital who are medically cleared, do not need to be in the hospital, but they can't leave because there's nowhere to go for continued care. And it might be because there's no nursing home beds available, which could be staffing. It might be because Medicaid eligibility is taking too long. It could be because of guardianship delays and not being able to do paperwork. Those 200 people who are constantly in our system, I mean, think about it. That's a whole hospital in and of itself inside our system. Every day they're there past being medically cleared, which is days, weeks, and months, all of that care is uncompensated. All of that is absorbed in the healthcare system. So when you have all these thousands and millions of dollars of costs that just don't get accounted for and paid for, it drives everything up.
Thank you. We'll go to Senator Giesel, and then I ask my colleagues, let's go on to the next presentation in the interest of time. Senator Giesel.
Sure. I would just highlight, you brought up the social determinants of health, community health workers. Yeah. Working in our communities. Of course, they're not compensated right now. We'd like to see them compensated. I know the Department of Health is working on that. I had a bill to do it. They're going to do it through regulation. But these are low cost, and they start with those determinants of health, food, community, all those kinds of things. So anyway, that's a low cost preventative measure. Thank you.
Senator Giesel. Thank you, Mr. Cosin. If you hang out in case we have questions later. But for now, we'll go to Director Carpenter. If you please come forward, put yourself on the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Chair Dunbar and members of the committee. My name is Heather Carpenter, and I'm the Director of the Division of Insurance. I was asked to come today to share some information about our 1332 waiver and some information about tax credits and how those have been impacted. Whenever we talk about health insurance and the Division of Insurance, we like to just give a grounding of what we have regulation or regulatory authority over. So the division has oversight of about 15% of the healthcare market. It's that little pie piece in yellow, and that is the individual market, the small group market, which is for employers with under 50 employees, and the large group market, which is over 50 employees. So looking at the individual market, our initial calendar year 2026 enrollment data from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, or CMS, does not yet include the consumers who actually paid that first month's premium and effectuated their coverage. We don't anticipate we'll get those reports until May from CMS, and I know we're all very anxious to get that information. On average, our rates did decrease for calendar year 2026. I have that information in a couple of slides. Our Alaska reinsurance program continues to lower rates by about 40%, and it does bring some much needed stability to the market. However, many consumers are still paying more because of the discontinuation of the enhanced premium tax credits that Mr. Cosin highlighted. So we recognize this has created some uncertainty for our consumers. So moving to slide 4, from the latest open enrollment data we have received from CMS, we had 26,079 individuals who selected a plan. And again, we don't know yet how many of those actually effectuated that coverage. Just for comparison, in calendar year 2025, there were 26,732 individuals in May 2025 that actually paid for that coverage. Moving on to slide five, this is a visual of our rates in the individual market since the ACA started, the rate changes, I should say. In 2014, we actually had five insurers in the individual market. However, that quickly changed, and this chart is showing rates for Primera and Moda, who are two insurers in the individual market now. Only one insurer in the individual market is not competitive, and we were awfully close to that being the situation for calendar year 2017. And you may remember there that was when we passed the Alaska Reinsurance Program, and I will highlight that in the next couple of slides. But a couple of things to point out about years on this. 2017, where you see a stabilization, that was the first year of the reinsurance program that had state funding. And 2018 was the first year with the federal waiver. However, even though there was a slight decrease in 2026, this comes after three recent years of rate increases, which are now being felt by individuals. Moving on to slide six, just some overview about the Alaska reinsurance creation. The Affordable Care Act allows states to apply for 1332 innovation waivers. The Division of Insurance, under the leadership of former Director Lori Wing-Hire, who I have to say is sitting in the room and could probably give this history in her sleep and in far greater detail than I ever could. She worked with the legislature. I know two of our committee members will remember the legislation that created this, and she worked with members to create and ask the federal government to allow us to apply for a 1332 waiver. So in 2016, that passed as HB 374. It also had a fiscal note or an appropriation for 1 year of $55 million. And we actually have to apply to both CMS, so the Department of Health and Human Services, CMS, and the United States Department of Treasury, because it's actually Treasury who does the tax credit portion. Okay, on slide seven, the Alaska Reinsurance Program is actually condition-based. And so we have 35 high-risk conditions that are paid for by the reinsurance program, and that removes them from the risk pool of the insurer. And the point there is that if we get those high-cost conditions out of the risk pool, the overall cost of insurance for the rest of the pool will go down. So a practical example of how this works, somebody could be on the list that has hepatitis C, and they get an ear infection that requires an urgent care visit. The insurer takes all of the claims for that and actually cedes it to our reinsurance program pool to pay the cost. And this works because the ACA provides individual market consumers with subsidies called advanced premium tax credits. Those are based on their income. So again, as the overall premium drops due to the reinsurance program, the amount of the tax credits the federal government has to pay for those consumers also goes down. And the waiver was premised on the fact that we would ask CMS and the Treasury to share some of those savings back with the state to fund the reinsurance program. In 2017, our application was approved. We were the first state reinsurance program in the country. In 2022, our waiver, which was a five-year program, was extended for an additional 5 years. I'm really proud to point out that through calendar year, we are funded on a calendar year, not a fiscal year, 2025, the waiver has redirected over $800 million back into the reinsurance program. And again, that is reducing our rates by 40%. Our current waiver expires at the end of calendar year 2027. So we are going to start gearing up this calendar year to work on that waiver renewal application. Slide nine just gives you a little bit of a visual of how this funding works. So each year, the division submits to CMS and Treasury what our rates would be with and without the waiver. The federal government takes that and determines what those advanced premium tax credits would be with and without the waiver. And then we're awarded a portion of those savings. We don't get all of the savings, but we get generally a pretty large amount of them. Slide 10 is an overview of the funding for our program back to inception in 2017. I will point out that the second column is the projected pass-through funding that our contract actuaries, Oliver Wyman, actually estimated the state would need in our original application. And you'll see quickly, in the third column, our program amount that has been set by the division has exceeded that amount almost every year. Of note, the claims that have been ceded to the program by those insurers for those 35 high-risk conditions have exceeded that program amount every year. So again, highlighting the conversation you were having with Jared Cozen about chronic conditions, and it really does drive the cost of healthcare. That next column is the federal pass-through amount. I will note that we have not received our calendar year 2026 award. What gets tricky with us setting our program amount is I had to sign off on the program amount back in June, the division did, and we knew we would not get our award until potentially May or June of this calendar year. But our insurers start filing rates for the next calendar year with us in June, and they need to know what to estimate so they can calculate that into their rate setting. So when there is a difference, we so far have been able to fund that with excess pass-through funding. That happened, the calculation for the federal award went in the favor of the state for several years, and so we had excess money that we were able to bank and pull down. That money will be totally spent this calendar year, and we'll need to start drawing on our ceded premium funds, which I will share some more information on in the next slide. So slide 11, we do have the reinsurance program ceded premium account, and insurers, again, who are participating in this in the individual market have to cede any premiums those consumers pay who have those 35 high-risk conditions, as well as any pharmacy rebates or other rebates they receive for those individuals. And those funds make up the ceded premium account, and this is held by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association, or ACHIA. And ACHIA uses the ceded premium account just to fund the administrative expenses of the program. So it's very administratively useful to do it this way for us. It keeps the cost low for the division. It was also the state, or the source of the state portion of the waiver payments in 2018. The legislature, you may remember, has appropriated money out of this account over two different years. For a total of $10 million, we then gave through an RSA to the Department of Health for Medicaid programs. One of those was the Medicaid rate review study that was actually funded through these dollars. And in part, we recognize that what they're doing over there in their program and rates is going to impact this market. So for this calendar year, 2026, and next calendar year, 2027, we anticipate that the federal award pass-through funding is not going to be enough to make that program amount. And this is what we're estimating with our contract actuaries. So our plan is to use part of that ceded premium account to make up the difference. And we're estimating that we're going to need about $85 million of that account for the next two calendar years.
Can I ask a question there, Director? Thank you for this. This is really good information about the reinsurance program. So two questions. Can you dig a little deeper, explain why the federally awarded pass-through funding will not be sufficient? Like, why aren't we getting a sufficient amount there? Like, what's the challenge there? And then second, with the ceded consumer premiums, and this is from, you know, private insurance, right? Some private sector insurer has provided those. Why do insurers cover those folks knowing they're going to have to cede their premiums? Is it a function of, you know, a legal mandate? Or I guess if you could clarify for me, why don't they just drop out of that portion of the market, or can they not do so?
Through the chair, Dunbar, I'll answer the first question first, because that one's definitely a little bit easier. The reason our pass-through is not going to be enough is the federal government corrected that mistake in their calculation, and it was, you know, at least described to me that it was never intended to always be more, and for the state to not have some skin in the game. So we're, you know, looking at that, and even, you know, we estimated, even if we drastically lowered our program amount from 140, say down to 100 million, we still would have had to come up with a state portion. It's just how the calculations work. And I am not an actuary, so I am not going to even start to try to explain more detail, but I can certainly follow up if you need more explanation.
Well, just on that before you go on. So what, say again, is it ceded premiums or what is going to plug that gap?
It is our ceded premium account.
Okay. So there's no general fund ask there.
Correct. Okay. And that is really important to underscore that we do have the ceded premium account to cushion that. So we do not have to have a general fund ask.
And then I'll ask again, why do private insurers participate knowing they have to cede the premiums? Why don't they just not offer those particular people coverage?
I think one of the easiest answers is the Affordable Care Act does not allow them to deny coverage. You know, you can't exclude somebody because they have a pre-existing condition. Mm-hmm. So this program, I mean, our insurers want to stay in the market. They want to be good partners. So it is a program that has at least worked to help stabilize so they can stay in the market.
Yes, very good. Thank you for that answer. You want to continue, please?
So moving to slide 12, I'm going to try to explain this high level because it's a little bit about how the advanced premium tax credit calculation is figured out. So to give a little bit of grounding, in our market, we have three types of plans: gold, silver, and bronze. Gold plans typically have a lower deductible. Bronze have a higher deductible. Our gold plan is typically priced higher and bronze plans are typically priced lower. So that leaves silver plans right in the middle. So the Affordable Care Act set up a mechanism to provide contributions for premium for consumers based on household income. And they base it on the amount between the second lowest cost silver plan and the consumer's contribution amount is the household subsidy. And that's known as the advanced premium tax credits. So it's truly, when you hear second lowest cost silver plan, don't get too wrapped up in that. So during the COVID pandemic, as you already heard, the federal government passed enhanced premium tax credits in 2021. That was originally supposed to be for 2021 and 2022. Those ended up being extended through calendar year 2025. Those enhanced tax credits expired December 31st, 2025. However, the underlying and the original advanced premium tax credits do continue. Okay, I think we are on to examples. So on slide 13, the division has been asked a lot over the last year for examples on what a consumer will pay with the expiration of the enhanced premium tax credits. This slide and the next give examples based on 2026 rates. So this slide is a single adult example, and the next slide is for a family of four. And I will just point you to the white paper we provided to the committee that also has these charts and other examples, and has really been a useful piece of information for people who have had questions about what are the poverty levels, what, you know, how many people did we have in each of those categories. So that is the information on this slide and slide 14. And Chair Dunbar, I'm happy to take any questions.
Yes. Let's see, I don't have any online. So this is, to reiterate, this is with the EPTC already backed out. Is that correct?
Chair Dunbar, yes. You can see the difference in the last two columns. It's the premium with the advanced premium tax credits, and again with the that premium change due to the expiration of the enhanced premium tax credits. And the payment changes based on your income level, so based on your federal poverty level percentage.
And these are household, not individual income. So I'll give, you know, I think it's about the median income, actually. Silver plan, $78,000 household income for the whole household, so that's not living the high life. $876 a month is the increase to that person, according to this. That's really, really a substantial amount of money for a family that's making less than $80,000 combined.
Well, Chair Dunbar, I will just point out that the reason we did this at 401% is because now with the expiration of the enhanced premium tax credit, if you have an income greater than 400%, now you no longer qualify for any advanced premium tax credits, and you're feeling the full weight of that monthly premium. So that is the group that is feeling the most change as a result of the loss of those tax credits.
Yeah. It's a really tremendous increase in expense for a lot of our households. Are there any other questions on this slide? Can we have one more? Are we on slide 13 or 14 right now? We're on was 13, so let's go to 14.
And slide 14 is, again, just those examples for a family of four.
Okay, so I see. So that was single, even though it's a household, that was a single adult. So in this case, it's a little bit more family of four, $161,000. So that's a significantly higher than our median income in Alaska. But still, a $2,000 a month increase is not insignificant.
Chair Dunbar, I would agree. It's not insignificant. And we recognize, I mean, this is a decision about a mortgage payment, you know, for some people versus health insurance. And we recognize those are really hard decisions for families to make.
Is there anything that we can do about this? I mean, is there anything? What could we at the state level do to try to mitigate this?
Chair Dunbar, I think those are the conversations that are happening around the healthcare community. Part of it is happening with the Rural Healthcare Transformation Program. How can we make decisions and invest those dollars that are going to impact the entire healthcare market? I think it's looking at how do we address chronic conditions to help lower the cost of health insurance. Additionally, you know, some states have passed state programs to try to replace some of these enhanced premium tax credits. That's not a quick fix. And again, that takes dollars that we just, you know, we're in tough budget times right now.
Sure.
We explored the option of could we make changes with our waiver? That's an 18-month process. So, you know, we quickly came to the fact that for calendar year 2026, we had no way to substitute the loss of those federal subsidies that could only be extended by Congress. So we've tried to increase the availability of alternative products on the market. The legislature has authorized different ways to do that over the years. That would include direct primary care. Last year in our insurance omnibus bill, we updated our health discount plan statutes. We had at least one, I think two, new health discount plans file or register with the division. Of course, there's healthcare sharing ministries. None of these are the full extent of this type of insurance. But, you know, we're trying to look at all options on the table.
Very good. Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just had to do some back of the napkin math. Can you go back to the individual plan? So just reminding the listening public that the bronze plan still comes with a deductible, and there's still caps. So even though it's only a $13 increase, there are other costs that someone will incur if they choose a bronze plan over potentially the silver plan. Additionally, I just looked at what the living wage calculator for a single adult is in Anchorage. It's $24.40 an hour you would need to make, which is about $50,000. And it's hard for me to think of someone being able to make $50,000 a year in this silver plan to get access to healthcare who might have a chronic condition and not have a significant impact to their life, to their ability to eat healthy and maybe to deal with some of the consequences of that chronic plan. So I just want to point out to the public that there are other components that aren't outlined on this particular slide that I think Senator Giesel spoke to as well, which is those social determinants of health, that the other pieces that are going to be sacrificed because of the passage of HR1.
Thank you, Senator Tobin. Thank you, Director. I don't see any other questions. We have one more presentation. If you please hang out in case we have any other questions. But thank you for this sobering presentation. We will move on now to Shayla Teague. She's the Area Director for ARC Insurance Solutions. She should be on Teams. Do we have her up on Teams? Oh, there she is. I'm looking at the wrong screen. Hello, Ms. Teague. If you would please put yourself on the record and begin your presentation.
Yes, hello, my name is Shayla Teague. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. I'm a licensed health insurance broker here in Anchorage, Alaska, and I've worked primarily in the individual and family market since 2019. At one point, I assisted with roughly 10% of Alaska's marketplace enrollments, and I currently sit on a CMS committee providing feedback on how the marketplace functions in Alaska. My perspective today comes from real conversations with Alaskan families, small business owners, and self-employed workers that are trying to figure out how they're going to afford healthcare. One important thing to understand about rising healthcare costs is that insurance premiums are not arbitrary numbers as we've seen today. They reflect the underlying cost of care within the entire healthcare system. Nationally, health insurance premiums are projected to rise about 8.5% next year, which is the third consecutive year at that elevated level. When healthcare costs rise nationally, Alaska tends to feel those increases more quickly and more dramatically because our market is smaller and less competitive than in the states. Several factors are driving these increases. Here are some examples from the PwC Health Research Institute. Hospitals facing higher labor and operating costs, expensive new medications like the GLP-1 drugs that's used for both diabetes and weight loss, rapid growth in specialty drugs and advanced gene and cell therapies, increased demand for behavioral health care since the pandemic. Those costs move through the healthcare system and ultimately show up in the premiums that people pay for insurance coverage. In Alaska, those national trends are often magnified. We have a small insurance risk pool, significant provider shortages, and unique geographic challenges that increase the cost of delivering care. Alaska ranks in the top 5 states for healthcare spending per capita, and that's about 20 to 30% higher than what we see nationally. And that means that when healthcare costs rise nationally, the impact on Alaska consumers can be particularly severe. For the past several years, many marketplace consumers were partially shielded from these rising healthcare costs due to the enhanced premium tax credits that were enacted during the pandemic. Those enhanced credits expanded eligibility and eliminated what had been known as the subsidy cliff, allowing middle-income households to receive financial assistance even if their income exceeded 400% of the federal poverty level. This was particularly significant in Alaska, where roughly 95% of marketplace enrollees received tax credits to help offset the cost of coverage, and that is about 5% higher than the national average. As those enhanced tax credits have expired, many Alaskan households are now experiencing what can be described as significant premium shock. This most recent marketplace open enrollment was one of the most difficult of my career. Many clients were in shock and some were even in tears. Conversations that typically take about 30 minutes often required 2 or 3 hour appointments. People delayed making decisions until the last possible moment, hoping the enhanced tax credits would be extended. They simply could not believe that they were being asked to pay double or even triple what they had paid in prior years. There was also widespread confusion. Many consumers believed that all financial assistance was going away entirely, and that caused some to disengage from the enrollment process, even if they did still qualify for help. This experience was not isolated. It was something that I saw over and over again during open enrollment. One example illustrates what many Alaskans are now facing. I work with a married couple in their late 50s with an annual household income of about $115,000. In Alaska, that's a solid middle-class income. Because their income slightly exceeds the eligibility threshold, they now receive no financial assistance. Last year, their monthly premium was approximately $600. This year, the same plan costs approximately $3,300 per month. This is not for an exceedingly rich plan. It is actually the least expensive plan available to them, and it still carries a $10,000 annual out-of-pocket maximum for each of them. Prior to the pandemic, a similar couple might have paid closer to $1,500 per month, but even those costs have steadily increased over time. This is not a one-off situation. It's what I'm seeing time and time again. Many middle-income Alaskans are reaching a point where coverage is simply no longer affordable, even for households that would traditionally be considered financially stable. As a result, some individuals are choosing to go uninsured. We've already seen at least an 11% decline in marketplace enrollment, and that number is expected to increase further as we move through the end of grace periods for premium payments. When people cannot afford coverage, they often go uninsured or they delay care. That leads to several downstream consequences, like delayed treatment, higher emergency care utilization, an increase to uncompensated care, and ultimately higher costs throughout the entire healthcare system. In other words, when coverage becomes unaffordable, the costs don't disappear. They shift elsewhere in the system and continue to impact future premium increases. My goal today isn't to advocate for a specific policy solution, but simply to share what I'm seeing firsthand. Rising healthcare costs are not an abstract issue for Alaskan families. They are decisions people are making every day about whether they can afford insurance, whether they delay medical care, or whether they take on significant financial risk in order to stay covered. Thank you for the opportunity to share my perspective with you today, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. T. That was a very interesting presentation. I don't see any questions from Senator Myers. I'm going to editorialize for a second, then I'll ask you a question. I'll say you said two things there that I think are really interesting. You said a lot of things, but two things in particular. The underlying drivers of healthcare costs that are reflected in insurance rates. The insurance rates don't just fall out of the sky. They are tied to actual underlying costs. That is a long-term challenge that I think everyone here is interested in solving. In the short term, there is this cliff that was created by the expiration of the enhanced premium tax credits. And the only realistic time to change that was in the reconciliation process and in HR 1. And because Congress did not do so, I think Congress is going to look very different next year. That is, even folks who traditionally might have voted one way are likely to vote a different way. And we're going to see a huge changeover in the who is in Congress. So, but now to my question. That was my editorializing. Now I want to ask you a question. You said something very specific, which is interesting, about the GLP-1, this very expensive sort of revolutionary drug that I think, I can't remember what country it's from, but it's so important that it's like changed the GDP of that country. It's a European country. But my question is, I was under the impression that while it was expensive, it also reduced certain chronic conditions or had sort of wide-ranging health impacts and thus maybe lowered costs in certain places too. Is that true or is that a misconception on my part? I'm not a medical expert, obviously.
So through the chair, I also have to say I'm not a medical expert, but I my understanding is that it is helping with other chronic conditions, but it's not – that's not on label. Those are off-label uses. And typically insurance will only cover for diabetes and weight loss. And I think there's a few other conditions at this time.
And so the diabetes is an interesting example, though. I mean, the cost savings from improving people's situation with diabetes, does that not sort of overwhelm the cost of GLP-1 itself, or has that sort of not been the experience for providers?
I think we're seeing such a huge increase on the population in general being on GLP-1s. Uh-huh. It's noted as a significant driver of healthcare costs, along with other pharmaceuticals as well.
Right.
That was certainly just an example, but pharmaceuticals in general is going to be a large driver in healthcare costs and health insurance premiums.
Yeah. And we have discussed pharmacy benefit managers here. My vice chair has done a lot of work on that as well. Also an interesting, maybe thorny subject. Does anyone have a question for Ms. Teague? Senator Giesel.
Well, it's not so much a question, it's more a rhetorical comment. How does Canada do it? I mean, they provide health care that is subsidized, available to all the citizens. Somehow they're managing. Anyway.
Yeah. Senator Klayman, do you have a comment on that or anything else?
Not a comment. I share the same question that Senator Giesel asked, and I think everyone on the panel asked. Really, on a much, much more practical level, when you're selling in individual insurance plans, is it just Primera and one other that you can offer for sale, or do you have more options than just the two?
We only have Primera and Moda Health. Those are the only two options that are true insurance available to Alaskans on the individual market.
Can you tell us what, in rough percentages, how many folks that are your clients sign up for Primera and how much sign up for Moda? And if that's confidential, you don't have to answer.
It's not confidential. I've seen a high favor for Primera in years past, but that is changing. And I would say it's a lot closer to half and half now. Moda has lower premiums. And while they have a more limited network, they are growing and people are searching for the least expensive option. So we are seeing more and more choose Moda Health.
And then I think my last, and this is all in the practical sense, what is your sense about Moda's network, in-network, and Primera's in-network providers, if you know information on that? And if you don't know,
Primera,
that's okay.
Primera has the largest network in Alaska on the individual market. They're available in more rural areas as well, where there are some markets that Moda is not available in at all. The Villages, for example. Moda, I know over the last year or so, has added about 700 to 800 providers. They used to be very, very limited. But I know that they're working really hard to change that.
Thank you. Thank you, Sam. I don't see any further questions. Thank you very much for coming, Ms. Teague, and all of our presenters. I think it's been a really good conversation today. And again, sobering to see the spike in costs that a number of our residents and constituents are facing. We're going to take a brief at ease so we can set up for the next bill. We are back on the record. Finally, today, we are holding an introductory hearing on SB 276, Contraceptives and Insurance Coverage. SB 276 is sponsored by this committee. Today, we are hearing from my staff, Ariel Harbison, who will introduce the bill as well as walk us through a sectional. After the introduction, we have three individuals invited online I'm sorry, online for invited testimony. We also have in the room, again, Director Heather Carpenter from Division of Insurance available for questions. Also online for questions, we have Charles Semling, a pharmacist with the Department of Health. Let me double check. Yes, that is the case. All right. With that, Ms. Harbison, if you please put yourself on the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Chair Dunbar and members of the Senate Health and Social Services Committee. My name is Arielle Harbison, staff to Senator Dunbar. I'm here to talk about SB 76, contraceptives and insurance coverage. Having access to contraceptives is an essential part of reproductive health care. Contraceptives provide many health, social, and economic benefits and allows women to practice reproductive autonomy. Currently, many prescription contraceptives are dispensed at a 1 to 3 month supply. Women in Alaska, especially rural Alaska, face many obstacles accessing reproductive health care for a variety of reasons, including but not limited to geographic barriers, lack of infrastructure, access to a post office or clinic, and the list goes on. Inconsistent access increases the chances of accidental pregnancies and other adverse health effects from disrupted use. Currently, there are 29 states and DC that require insurers to cover an extended supply of 12 months of contraceptives at a time. What SB 276 aims to do is put into Alaska statutes language that is consistent with the standards set in the federal contraceptive coverage guarantee. So it's going to mandate dispensing of 12 months of prescriptive contraceptives at a time. Research featured in the Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology in your bill packet shows that women who are dispensed a 12-month supply of contraceptives have a 30% drop in unplanned pregnancy and a 46% drop in the likelihood of abortion than a woman who is dispensed a 1 to 3 month supply. This bill is written does not increase the cost for insurance companies or individuals, and you'll notice that it's got a zero fiscal note. In fact, it saves money for the state. In 2024, the then Department of Health and Social Services fiscal note estimated a similar bill would result in a $1.35 million savings annually due to a reduction in unplanned pregnancies. We urge you to support Senate Bill 276. It provides Alaskan women with the necessary support to improve family planning while decreasing healthcare costs.
Thank you, Ms. Harbison. I think now we will go, we have a sectional we can go through briefly, and then we'll go to invited testimony.
Yeah, so Arielle Harbison for the record. I've got a shortened sectional here. Section 1 is where the meat of this bill lies. And so Section 1, AS 2142427, adds a new section that requires a healthcare insurer to provide coverage for contraceptive prescription and medical services. It requires reimbursement for dispensing prescription contraceptives intended to last for a 12-month period. It prevents the insurer from offsetting the cost of compliance. It prevents the insurer from restricting or delaying coverage for contraceptives. And if a provider recommends a particular service or FDA-approved item based on medical necessity, the plan or insurer must cover that cost or item without cost sharing. It exempts religious employers if certain criteria are met. In sections 2 through 5, they include conforming language to apply section 1 to different healthcare plans. Section 6 is going to require the Department of Health to pay for 12 months of prescription contraceptives for eligible recipients of medical assistance. Section 7 of uncodified law requires the Department of Health to immediately amend and submit for the federal approval a state plan for medical assistance coverage consistent with Section 6. Section 8 of uncodified law makes Section 6 of the Act conditional on the approval required under Section 7. And lastly, Section 9, uncodified law. If under Section 8 of this Act, Section 6 takes effect, it takes effect on the day after the date the federal government approves the state plan amendment or determines an amendment is not necessary.
Thank you, Ms. Harbison. At this time, we have several invited testifiers. I received a text from Senator Myers. He has a question, but he's going to hold it till after the invited testifiers. But everyone remind me if it looks like I've forgotten. So now we will go to Dr. Ingrid Johnson. Dr. Johnson, could you please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony?
Yes, thank you, Chair Dunbar, and thank you to the committee. This is Dr. Ingrid Johnson. I am an associate professor of justice at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. I am speaking today on my behalf only and not on behalf of the university, the Board of Regents, or the university's officers. I am an expert on gender-based violence within the field of criminology. I study how people who've experienced gender-based violence seek help and attain that help. And I also study other aspects like the prevalence. So I was the principal investigator for the Alaska Victimization Study, as all of you have interacted with me in that capacity before. So this will be a lot of the same statistics I spoke with you all about last week, but now specific to Senate Bill 276 and the importance of extended coverage for up to 12 months of contraception of the patient's preference. So I did submit a fact sheet in advance. Again, it's going to look very similar to the one that I went over last week, but I will just talk through those numbers again and talk about how they relate to this bill specifically. So the first bullet point enumerates that one in two Alaskan women have had partners who control what they can do, where they can go, and other aspects of their life. So this is coercive control and entrapment behaviors where partners exert control over their partner's lives in all kinds of ways. So in particular, when thinking about access to birth control, what this means is this can make regular trips to a medical provider and or a pharmacy difficult. So if they're required to go back to the pharmacy every 1 to 3 months to get their contraceptive prescription, that can be made much more difficult when they have a partner who is regularly monitoring and controlling those behaviors and where they go. On the second bullet point, we see that one in five Alaskan women have experienced reproductive control. And I should note that these are numbers from the 2020 Alaska Victimization Survey. And these are lifetime experiences. So one in five have experienced reproductive control, which makes ease of access to contraceptives essential in reducing unintended pregnancies. So reproductive control is things like partners trying to get them pregnant when they didn't want to be, or trying to get them to stop using birth control, partners refusing to use a condom when they wanted to use one. So again, trying to prevent those lapses in contraception is very important. So having a regular supply that they don't have to try to go get when they're living with a controlling partner who's controlling their movements on a monthly or maybe 3 month basis would be very beneficial for people in those types of situations. We also know that Alaskan women are at a high risk for intimate partner sexual assault, thus increasing their risk for unintended pregnancies, particularly if there's a lap in that preferred contraception regime. This is an unweighted estimate. The rest of these are weighted estimates, but from an unweighted estimate, this is combining all of the AVS data. This was from a report I prepared a few years ago. I found that in that that group of women, almost one in five had experienced a sexual assault by an intimate partner specifically. That's different from sexual assault overall, but this is sexual assault by an intimate partner, so one in five. We know that getting pregnant puts women at an increased risk for violent victimization, particularly for women already in abusive relationships. That's not data from the ABS, that's data from other studies. So qualitative research has demonstrated that abusive partners will attempt to forcibly impregnate their partners to keep them from leaving the relationship. And we've seen in other research that pregnancy increases women's risk of being a victim of homicide. And we know that Alaska has the highest rate of women killed by men in the United States, with a rate that's more than twice the national average. So already in these abusive relationships, they're at a high risk. But then if they get pregnant, that puts them at an even higher risk to be trapped in that abusive relationship and or to become a victim of homicide. And then when we look outside intimate relationships, when we look to just the prevalence of sexual violence in the state of Alaska, we see that 2 in 5 Alaskan women have experienced either attempted or completed forced and or alcohol drug-involved non-consensual sexual penetration. So that's a very long way of saying they've experienced attempted or completed sexual assault 1 or sexual assault 2. And so, again, that's sexual assault that could be by an intimate partner or it could be by someone else. So this is different from the other number. And we also know that 1 in 3 have experienced coerced sexual penetration. So people using lies, threats, demands, their authority to pressure them. So this would be something that outside of criminal law, we would also consider to be sexual assault, just not necessarily always by law. So we know that 1 in 6 female rape and or sexual coercion victims get pregnant as a result of that rape or sexual coercion. So it's important to consider, you know, what kind of contraception is available for all Alaskan women, as Alaskan women are at a very high risk of being sexually assaulted or coerced. And experiencing unintended pregnancy as a result of that rape and coercion. And that concludes my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Johnson. Are there any questions specifically for Dr. Johnson? I don't see any, but if you'll stay on the line, Dr. Johnson, if someone wants to come back to you, we have about 15 minutes left. We have 2 more testifiers. Next, we will go to, I seem to have lost the page. Let me look here. We might have to go a little bit. Oh, there it is. Ms. Claudia Haynes, CEO of Kachemak Bay Family Planning Clinic. Ms. Haynes, would you please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony?
Hi, good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Claudia Haynes. I'm the CEO at Kachemak Bay Family Planning Clinic based in Homer. And I'm here today to discuss the positive impact SB 276 will have on Alaskans, particularly women living in rural regions of our state. So KBFPC providers support clients from adolescence to menopause with evidence-based reproductive health care. And I'm going to give a brief description because this kind of grounds us in the kind of knowledge about this work. So we offer confidential care regardless of a client's ability to pay, including a large amount of birth control counseling, both at our brick and mortar clinic and through our pop-up services. And while our clients live on the Kenai Peninsula, they work around the state. So every day, our providers see firsthand how access to contraception affects the lives of Alaskans. Our providers empower clients to choose the birth control that fits their needs about when and if to have a family, as well as how to space births to raise their family in the healthiest way possible. Our providers also treat medical conditions like PCOS and endometriosis, both of which are painful conditions that can lead to infertility if untreated. Contraception, the focus of today's hearing, is used to reduce unintended pregnancies, yes, but also these serious conditions. And in all of these cases, uninterrupted, continuous access to contraception is essential. So whether to use or not use contraception and which contraceptive method to use is a private medical decision that is made by a patient in consultation with their healthcare provider, not an insurance carrier. Medical providers are extensively trained in how to prescribe contraception safely and when quantity restrictions may be warranted. But right now, medical providers like those here at KBFPC need to also anticipate the challenges clients have to actually accessing the contraception they are prescribed. So including insurance denials and restrictions on quantity, Geographic proximity, as Ariel talked about, to a pharmacy or clinic, transportation, and even work schedules alignment to pharmacy hours. So let me just give you an example. We have many clients who prefer the NuvaRing ring for their birth control. Medicaid only allows them to pick up one ring at a time, the equivalent of one per month. So this equates to a lot of time in the pharmacy waiting in line or logistical challenges if the client works away from their home community here on the peninsula. So if clients are late picking up a ring, the gap puts them at much higher risk for unintended pregnancy. Clients have even ended up switching methods due to this issue, potentially choosing a less effective method. So when insurance companies force people to use alternate contraceptive methods that are not recommended for them in order to get what they actually need, they cause inefficiencies in the system and may cause harm to Alaskans. And we know that 1 in 4 women have missed birth control pills because they could not get the next pack in time. So our national focus on improving rural healthcare is the perfect time to highlight the disparities Alaskans face in accessing the care they need, which includes even these smaller seeming issues like being able to get 12 months of birth control at a time. So we need to find solutions to both the big problems that we were just talking about earlier in the hearing and these not so big problems to improve all the health outcomes of Alaskans. And so, as Ariel also said, Alaskans are not alone in our need for better access to contraception as preventative care and life-saving treatment. And fortunately, 29 states, including DC, have already enacted similar legislation to guide the way. Addressing loopholes in insurance practices via state law will protect Alaskans without a large price tag and maybe even a savings for the state. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Haynes. I'll note here as well, while this mandates the insurers provide up to 12 months of birth control, it doesn't mandate that a patient or their doctor have to choose it in 12-month increments. They could also choose, well, we just want 1 month or 3 month, up to 12 months. Thank you again for your testimony. Finally, we have Dr. Sarah Truitt, Glasses Section Chair from the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. Dr. Truitt, could you please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony?
Hi. Okay. Chair Dunbar and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak. My name is Dr. Sarah Truitt, and I serve as a chair of the Alaska Section for ACOG, representing 140 members across the state. I'm here today to express our strong support for SB 276. As OBGYNs practicing throughout Alaska, we regularly see how something as routine as refilling birth control can quickly become an obstacle for our patients. Could be a college student preparing to leave for the semester, a parent who can't get to the pharmacy before closing due to child driving around their children, a rural resident whose mail delivery is unpredictable. Each would benefit from the simple assurance of having a full year supply of her birth control on hand. As for me, more than 50% of my patients I see off the road system. I'm thinking about a couple of my women out in Chivac and Savunga who really rely on the mail service to get their prescriptions. And, you know, I'd like to give them a full year supply when I see them when I'm traveling to Nome or I'm at the office in Anchorage. That would be amazing. We wouldn't have to worry about delays. The challenge is not that our patients don't know how to use their medication or try to get refills in a timely fashion. The challenge is that life in Alaska, weather, distance, transportation, work schedules makes monthly or quarterly refills unrealistic. When people miss doses because they couldn't get to a pharmacy or their mail service is delayed, the consequences can be severe. Unintended pregnancies or worsening symptoms of conditions like endometriosis, fibroids, or heavy bleeding. These are conditions that require consistent treatment without any gaps. 12 months dispensing of contraceptions, as you've all heard, is not a new or untested idea. Many states have adopted the same policies and the benefits are clear as patients are more consistent with their contraception. Our patients deserve that same stability here in Alaska. SB 276 is not about changing anyone's medical treatment. It is simply about making sure the treatment we prescribe is accessible. Allowing a full year's supply acknowledges that Alaskans live complex and demanding lives in a geographically challenging state and trust them to manage their own health responsibly. In addition, allowing patients to pick up a full year of their birth control at once isn't just good for their health, but it's also cost effective, as fewer unintended pregnancies and gaps in care can create savings for health systems and insurers. On behalf of ACOG Alaska, we strongly support SB 276, and thank you for allowing me to speak today.
Thank you very much, Dr. Truitt. I don't see any questions specifically for you. We do have Senator Myers with a question. Senator Myers?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I don't know if this is going to be for you or one of the invited testifiers might be able to chime in on this, but I'm thinking about other medications that people take on a daily basis where if you miss a day or two, it can cause some serious problems, you know, whether we're talking about medications for something that treats something like, say, diabetes or depression, or I've got a family member who takes a daily medication just to help prevent migraine. And you miss a day and trying to come back from that is a 3 or 4 day ordeal, potentially. So I'm just curious if either we require in law or if it happens to be common practice among insurers already to dispense out up to 12 months for some of these other daily type medications.
That's an interesting question. Thank you, Senator Myers. I personally don't know the answer to that question. Perhaps one of our medical providers would have some knowledge about other kinds of medication. Dr. Truitt, do you happen to know about prescribing longer term prescriptions for other daily medications? It says unavailable. I wonder if she might have dropped, unfortunately. Senator Giesel, do you happen to hear?
I don't right offhand, Mr. Chairman. Sometimes insurance companies have a limit on how long duration, 3 months, 6 months, 1 year.
Yeah.
Perhaps our insurance director could comment on it. I'm not sure. I know some medications I prescribe for 3 months.
Yeah.
Because it's more affordable that way. A whole year, paying for a whole year at once can be a challenge.
Thank you. Director Carpenter, do you have any thoughts on Senator Myers' question?
For the record, Heather Carpenter, the director of the Division of Insurance, through the chair to Senator Myers, all I can really speak of is my own personal experience, which I have two medications that I get 3 months at a time, a statin and another immunosuppressant that I'm on. So I know, you know, my insurance, Alaska Care, covers that for 3 months at a time. Mm-hmm. We can certainly ask our carriers in the market if they have examples of what they, you know, how often or do they distribute some of those maintenance medications at 3 months or longer intervals. But off the top of my head, I just don't know.
Senator, thank you, Director. Senator Klayman.
It's not a question for Ms. Carpenter, but just on this topic. This legislation is not new to me.
Yes.
And I have no memory of any discussion of a provider coming in and saying, I can get 12 months for a statin, but I can't get 12 months for birth control. I think the pattern I recall is that the 3 months has been generally consistent on other medications. But I'm not testifying to it. It's just this legislation has been around a while.
Thank you. Senator Myers, do you have any follow-ups to that?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious if the Director of Insurance has a way of finding that out. I greatly appreciate that.
Very good. Yes, Director, if you get a chance, I will say that I intend to move this bill with all deliberate speed. And so if you could get those answers by Monday, that would be very helpful. If it's not practicable, we could also look to get those answers a little later in session. But it won't be in this committee, to say that, most likely. Okay, with that, are there any other thoughts? All right, I'm going to, we're going to set this bill aside.
Mr. Britt.
Yes, yeah. Go ahead, Senator.
Just a Clinton. Very, very brief comment. This legislation has been around a long time, and I'm very pleased this committee has picked it up and keeping going. Thank you.
I think that almost every member of this committee has carried this at some point, at least several of us have. And so for that reason, I do not intend to dwell on this legislation for very long. So today I am setting two amendment deadlines, one for HCR 4, the Myositis Awareness Month from Representative Sadler. I'm setting that for Monday at 5 p.m., this coming Monday, March 23rd. And also for SB 276, this bill, contraceptive insurance coverage, I'm also setting an amendment deadline for Monday at 5 p.m. The next meeting of the Senate Health and Social Services Committee will be held on Tuesday, March 24th. We will have a presentation from the OASA Coalition on Housing and Homelessness titled Housing is Healthcare. We will also have a second hearing for HCR 4, Myositis Awareness Month, and I intend to look to the will of the committee, and a hearing on SB 276, contraceptives insurance coverage. And again, I will intend to look to the will of the committee. So thank you, everyone, for a very productive hearing. This meeting is adjourned. It is currently 4:57 p.m.